This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
I'm Mike Rumble, and I'm reading The Last Gift by Phil Calloway. The older I get, the more I'm convinced that memory and smell are linked. I close my eyes, and I can almost smell Christmas sugar cookies baking, the turkey sizzling. I love the taste of Christmas. Mixed nuts, mandarin oranges, fresh dirt from one of my brother Tim's incoming snowballs. Ah, Christmas time. When I was a child of 8 or 9 and Christmas was barely a week away, I sinned greatly. I sneaked into Grandpa's room, listened to him snore, then reached out and stole an entire box of chocolates, locking myself in the bathroom and eating both layers. I can still taste those chocolates. I can still feel that strap. Few sins were worth the spanking. This one came close. It made me wonder if sometimes you're almost better off asking for forgiveness than permission. Each December morning, my sister and I would sit on a living room heat register inches from the Christmas tree, coveting toys from the Sears catalog. On the wall behind our heads, white frost had crept through the openings of an electrical outlet. Yesterday, I'd earned a nickel putting my tongue on it. But otherwise, I was a reasonably bright chap. The earth was somehow colder in those primitive days. Snowdrifts were higher. Winter was longer. As we sat on the heat vent, my sister pointed out certain toys in the catalog. "What do they do?" she asked. If I didn't know the answer, I made one up. "This doll's head wobbles side to side," I'd say. "Then it pops off." My sister was impressed with my knowledge. One page in particular held a dream for me. At the top right, just above a stuffed orange bear, sat a yellow-handled bow with real suction cup arrows. If only I could pull the wrapping off one of those, I told my sister, my Christmas would be complete. She shook her head. Impossible, she said. There's no money. And when I told my brother, he agreed with my sister. You kidding? He laughed. After what you did to Grandpa's chocolates, you'll be lucky to get a hand-me-down toothbrush. Deep down, I knew he was right. Deep down, I dreaded Christmas. But still, I shared the dream with my dad. $10.99, he winced. You want to put us in the poorhouse? I wondered what the poorhouse was like. What would we do there? Would Grandpa still come to visit? Would he bring chocolates? As December 25th drew near, I scanned the growing pile beneath the trees. Nothing. A shiny green package near the back was the right size, but late one night while everyone else slept, a flashlight informed me that the name tag was my sister's. In fact, most of them seemed to be hers. I squeezed the one that said Philip. They felt like practical gifts. Socks, deodorant, underwear. Things you don't tell your friends about on Boxing Day. The worst thing about Christmas morning was the waiting. My parents made us eat breakfast first, then do the dishes, and sweep floors, and vacuum carpets, and memorize the Gospel of Luke. Then Dad prayed for the troops in Vietnam and Korea and Russia, and missionaries in countries I couldn't pronounce. At last the time came, and this year the disappointment was overwhelming. With only 3 presents left beneath the tree, I held in my lap a small Tonka truck, 3 pairs of black socks, a shirt with pins in it, and a cowboy poster that read, "When you reach the end of your rope, tie a knot in it and hang on." The first remaining gift was a George Beverly Shea record album for my mom. The second was for Grandpa, a box of chocolates for my brother and me. The last gift was green and shiny and just the right size. My sister grinned and picked it up. Then the most unexpected thing happened. She turned and handed it to me. "Open it," she said. "It's yours. Tim put my name on it to fool you." Mom wanted me to save the wrapping paper for next year, but it was already too late. I let out a triumphant whoop and danced around the living room, holding the bow and arrow high like the Stanley Cup. Grandpa stopped sampling chocolates and smiled widely. "It's from all of us," he said. "You be careful with that, son," said my mother. "He'll be okay," said my dad. I remember only a handful of gifts from my childhood, a Detroit Red Wings hockey jersey, a Hot Wheels race car set. I remember ice skating and carol singing and candle making and Grandpa's story of a baby whose tiny brow was made for thorns, whose blood would one day cleanse the world. But it was the last gift that made Christmas come alive for me. You see, that bow and arrow caused me to realize that Christmas is all about grace, a gift I don't deserve, coming along when I least expect it, changing everything, forever. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. A child of 8 or 9 doesn't think of these things. I only knew at the time that I couldn't wait to try out the gift. I remember wolfing down turkey, my mom's special dressing, and pudding so thick you could hear it hit bottom. And I recall tiptoeing after my brother as he headed down the hallway that afternoon. I locked an arrow in place, took careful aim, and pulled on the string until it was tight. "Hey, Tim," I yelled, "Merry Christmas." And I wondered just for a moment if I should ask permission or forgiveness.
This is A March Christmas from Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, and I'm Anne Forstoffel. "Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents," grumbled Joe, lying on the rug. "It's so dreadful to be poor," sighed Meg, looking down at her old dress. "I don't think it's fair for some girls to have plenty of pretty things, and other girls nothing at all," added little Amy with an injured sniff. "We've got each other, and Father and Mother," said Beth contentedly from her corner. The four young faces on which the firelight shone brightened at the cheerful words, but darkened again as Joe said sadly, "We haven't got Father, and shall not have him for a long time." She didn't say, "Perhaps never," but each silently added it, thinking of Father far away, where the fighting was. Nobody spoke for a minute. Then Meg said in an altered tone, "You know the reason Mother proposed not having any presents this Christmas was because it is going to be a hard winter for everyone, and she thinks we ought not to spend money for pleasure when our men are suffering so in the army. We can't do much, but we can make our little sacrifices, and ought to do it gladly. But I'm afraid I don't," and Meg shook her head as she thought regretfully of all the pretty things she wanted. "But I don't think the little we should spend would do any good. We've each got a dollar, and the army wouldn't be much helped by our giving that. I agree not to spend anything for Mother or you, but I do want to buy Undine and Sintram for myself. I've wanted it so long," said Joe, who was a bookworm. "I've planned to spend mine in new music," said Beth with a little sigh, which no one heard but the hearthbrush and kettle holder. "I shall get a nice box of Faber's drawing pencils. I really need them," said Amy decidedly. "Mother didn't say anything about our money, and she won't wish us to give up everything. Let's each buy what we want and have a little fun. I'm sure we work hard enough to earn it," cried Joe, examining the heels of her shoes in a gentlemanly manner. "I know I do, teaching those tiresome children nearly all day, when I'm longing to enjoy myself at home," began Meg, in the complaining tone again. "You don't have half such a hard time as I do," said Joe. "How would you like to be shut up for hours with a nervous, fussy old lady who keeps you trotting, is never satisfied, and worries you till you're ready to fly out the window or cry?" "It's naughty to fret, but I do think washing dishes and keeping things tidy is the worst work in the world. It makes me cross, and my hands get so stiff I can't practice well at all." And Beth looked at her rough hands with a sigh that anyone could hear that time. "I don't believe any of you suffer as I do," cried Amy. "For you don't have to go to school with impertinent girls who plague you if you don't know your lessons and laugh at your dresses and label your father if he isn't rich and insult you when your nose isn't nice. If you mean libel, I'd say so, and not talk about labels as if Papa was a pickle bottle," advised Joe, laughing. "I know what I mean, and you needn't be satirical about it. It's proper to use good words and improve your vocabulary," returned Amy with dignity. "Don't peck at each other, children. Don't you wish we had the money Papa lost when we were little, Joe? Dear me, how happy and good we'd be if we had no worries," said Meg, who could remember better times. "You said the other day you thought we were a deal happier than the King children, for they were fighting and fretting all the time, in spite of their money."
"So I did, Beth."
"Well, I think we are. For though we do have to work, we make fun for ourselves, and we are a pretty jolly set, as Joe would say."
"Joe does use such slang words," observed Amy, with a reproving look at the long figure stretched on the rug. Joe immediately sat up, put her hands in her pockets, and began to whistle.
"Don't, Joe, it's so boyish."
"That's why I do it.
I detest rude, unladylike girls.
I hate affected niminy-piminy chits."
"Birds in their little nests agree," sang Beth, the peacemaker, with such a funny face that both sharp voices softened to a laugh, and the pecking ended for that time.
"Really, girls, you are both to be blamed," said Meg, beginning to lecture in her elder sisterly fashion.
"You are old enough to leave off boyish tricks and to behave better, Josephine. It didn't matter so much when you were a little girl, but now you are so tall and turn up your hair, you should remember that you are a young lady."
"I'm not, and if turning up my hair makes me one, I'll wear it in two tails till I'm 20," cried Joe, pulling off her net and shaking down a chestnut mane. "I hate to think I've got to grow up and be Miss March and wear long gowns and look as prim as a china aster. It's bad enough to be a girl anyway, when I like boys' games and work and manners. I can't get over my disappointment in not being a boy. It's worse than ever now, for I'm dying to go and fight with Papa, and I can only stay at home and knit like a poky old woman." And Joe shook the blue army sock till the needles rattled like castanets, and her ball bounded across the room.
"Poor Joe. It's too bad, but it can't be helped. So you must try to be contented with making your name boyish and playing brother to us girls," said Beth, stroking the rough head at her knee with a hand that all the dishwashing and dusting in the world could not make ungentle in its touch.
"As for you, Amy," continued Meg, "you are altogether too particular and prim. Your airs are funny now, but you'll grow up an affected little goose if you don't take care. I like your nice manners and refined way of speaking when you don't try to be elegant, but your absurd words are as bad as Joe's slang."
"If Joe is a tomboy and Amy a goose, what am I, please?" asked Beth, ready to share the lecture.
"You are a dear and nothing else," answered Meg warmly, and no one contradicted her, for the mouse was the pet of the family.
As young readers like to know how people look, we will take this moment to give them a little sketch of the four sisters, who sat knitting away in the twilight while the December snow fell quietly without and the fire crackled peacefully within. It was a comfortable old room, though the carpet was faded and furniture very plain. For a good picture or two hung on the walls, books filled the recesses, chrysanthemums and Christmas roses bloomed in the windows, and a pleasant atmosphere of home peace pervaded it. Margaret, the eldest of the four, was 16 and very pretty, being plump and fair with large eyes, plenty of soft brown hair, a sweet mouth, and white hands, of which she was rather vain. 15-year-old Joe was very tall, thin, and brown, and reminded one of a colt, for she never seemed to know what to do with her long limbs, which were very much in her way. She had a decided mouth, a comical nose, and sharp gray eyes, which appeared to see everything, and were by turns fierce, funny, or thoughtful. Her long, thick hair was her one beauty, but it was usually bundled into a net to be out of her way. Round shoulders had Joe, big hands and feet, a flyaway look to her clothes, and the uncomfortable appearance of a girl who was rapidly shooting up into a woman and didn't like it. Elizabeth, or Beth, as everyone called her, was a rosy, smooth-haired, bright-eyed girl of 13, with a shy manner, a timid voice, and a peaceful expression which was seldom disturbed. Her father called her Little Tranquility, and the name suited her excellently, for she seemed to live in a happy world of her own, only venturing out to meet the few whom she trusted and loved. Amy, the youngest, was the most important person, in her own opinion at least. A regular snow maiden, with blue eyes and yellow hair curling on her shoulders, pale and slender, and always carrying herself like a young lady mindful of her manners. What the characters of the four sisters were, we will leave to be found out. The clock struck six, and having swept up the hearth, Beth put a pair of slippers down to warm. Somehow the sight of the old shoes had a good effect upon the girls, for Mother was coming, and everyone brightened to welcome her. Meg stopped lecturing and lighted the lamp. Amy got out of the easy chair without being asked, and Joe forgot how tired she was as she sat up to hold the slippers near to the blaze. "They are quite worn out. Marmy must have a new pair."
"I thought I'd get her some with my dollar," said Beth.
"No, I shall," cried Amy. "I'm the oldest," began Meg, but Joe cut in with a decided, "I'm the man of the family now Papa is away, and I shall provide the slippers, for he told me to take special care of Mother while he was gone."
"I'll tell you what we'll do," said Beth. "Let's each get her something for Christmas, and not get anything for ourselves."
"That's like you, dear. What will we get?" exclaimed Joe. Everyone thought soberly for a minute. Then Meg announced, as if the idea was suggested by the sight of her own pretty hands, "I shall give her a nice pair of gloves."
"Army shoes, best to be had," cried Joe.
"Some handkerchiefs, all hemmed," said Beth.
"I'll get her a little bottle of cologne. She likes it, and it won't cost much, so I'll have some left to buy my pencils," added Amy.
"How will we give the things?" asked Meg.
"Put them on the table, and bring her in, and see her open the bundles. Don't you remember how we used to do on our birthdays?" answered Joe.
"Let Marmy think. We are getting things for ourselves, and then surprise her. We must go shopping tomorrow afternoon, Meg. There is so much to do about the play for Christmas night," said Joe, marching up and down with her hands behind her back and her nose in the air.
"I don't mean to act any more after this time. I'm getting too old for such things," observed Meg, who was as much a child as ever about dressing up frolics.
"You won't stop, I know, as long as you can trail around in a white gown with your hair down and wear gold paper jewelry.
You are the best actress we've got, and there'll be an end of everything if you quit the boards," said Joe. "We ought to rehearse tonight. Come here, Amy, and you do the fainting scene, for you are as stiff as a poker in that."
"I can't help it. I never saw anyone faint, and I don't choose to make myself all black and blue, tumbling flat as you do. If I can go down easily, I'll drop. If I can't, I shall fall into a chair and be graceful."
"I don't care if Hugo does come at me with a pistol," returned Amy, who was not gifted with dramatic power, but was chosen because she was small enough to be borne out shrieking by the villain of the piece.
"Do it this way. Clasp your hands so, and stagger across the room, crying frantically, 'Rodrigo, save me, save me!'" And away went Joe with a melodramatic scream, which was truly thrilling.
Amy followed, but she poked her hands out stiffly before her and jerked herself along as if she went by machinery. And her "ow!" was more suggestive of pins being run into her than of fear and anguish. Joe gave a despairing groan, and Meg laughed outright, while Beth let her bread burn as she watched the fun with interest.
"It's no use. Do the best you can when the time comes, and if the audience laughs, don't blame me. Come on, Meg."
"I don't see how you can write and act such splendid things, Joe. You're a regular Shakespeare," exclaimed Beth, who firmly believed that her sisters were gifted with wonderful genius in all things.
"Not quite," replied Joe modestly.
I do think The Witch's Curse, an operatic tragedy, is rather a nice thing. But I'd like to try Macbeth. If only we had a trapdoor for Banquo. I always wanted to do the killing part.
"Is this the dagger that I see before me?"
muttered Jo, rolling her eyes and clutching at the air as she had seen a famous tragedian do.
"No, it's the toasting fork with Mother's shoe on it instead of the bread. Beth's stage struck," cried Meg, and the rehearsal ended in a general burst of laughter.
"Glad to find you so merry, my girls," said a cheery voice at the door, and the actors and audience turned to welcome a tall, motherly lady with a can-I-help-you look about her, which was truly delightful. She was not elegantly dressed, but a noble-looking woman, and the girls thought the gray cloak and unfashionable bonnet covered the most splendid mother in the world. "Well, dearies, how have you got on today? There was so much to do getting the boxes ready to go tomorrow that I didn't come home to dinner. Has anyone called, Beth? How is your cold, Meg? Jo, you look tired to death. Come and kiss me, baby." While making these maternal inquiries, Mrs. March got her wet things off, her warm slippers on, and sitting down in the easy chair, drew Amy to her lap, preparing to enjoy the happiest hour of her busy day. The girls flew about, trying to make things comfortable, each in her own way. Meg arranged the tea table. Jo brought wood and set chairs, dropping, overturning, and clattering everything she touched. Beth trotted to and fro between parlor and kitchen, quiet and busy, while Amy gave directions to everyone as she sat with her hands folded. As they gathered about the table, Mrs. March said, with a particularly happy face, "I've got a treat for you after supper." A quick, bright smile went around like a streak of sunshine. Beth clapped her hands, regardless of the biscuit she held, and Jo tossed up her napkin, crying, "A letter! A letter! 3 cheers for a letter!" "Yes, a nice long letter. He is well, and thinks he shall get through the cold season better than we feared. He sends all sorts of loving wishes for Christmas, and an especial message for you girls," said Mrs. March, patting her pocket as if she had a treasure there.
"Hurry and get done. Don't stop to quirk your little finger and simper over your plate, Amy," cried Jo, choking in her tea and dropping her bread butter side down on the carpet in her haste to get at the treat.
Beth ate no more, but crept away to sit in her shadowy corner and brood over the delight to come till the others were ready.
"I think it was so splendid in Father to go as a chaplain when he was too old to be drafted and not strong enough for a soldier," said Meg warmly.
"Don't I wish I could go as a drummer, a Vivian, what's its name, or a nurse, so I could be near him and help him," exclaimed Jo with a groan.
"It must be very disagreeable to sleep in a tent and eat all sorts of bad-tasting things and drink out of a tin mug," sighed Amy.
"When will he come home, Marmee?" asked Beth, with a little quiver in her voice.
"Not for many months, dear, unless he is sick. He will stay and do his work faithfully as long as he can, and we won't ask for him to come back a minute sooner than he can be spared. Now come and hear the letter." They all drew to the fire, Mother in the big chair with Beth at her feet, Meg and Amy perched on either arm of the chair, and Jo leaning on the back, where no one could see any sign of emotion if the letter should happen to be touching. Very few letters were written in those hard times that were not touching, especially those which Father sent home. In this one, little was said of the hardships endured, the dangers faced, or the homesickness conquered. It was a cheerful, hopeful letter, full of lively descriptions of camp life, marches, and military news. And only at the end did the writer's heart overflow with fatherly love and longing for the little girls at home. "Give them all my dear love and a kiss. Tell them I think of them by day, pray for them by night, and find my best comfort in their affection at all times. A year seems very long to wait till I see them, but remind them that while we wait, we may all work, so that these hard days need not be wasted. I know they will remember all I said to them, that they will be loving children to you, will do their duty faithfully, fight their bosom enemies bravely, and conquer themselves so beautifully that when I come back to them, I may be fonder and prouder than ever of my little women. Everybody sniffled when they came to that part. Jo wasn't ashamed of the great tear that dropped off the end of her nose, and Amy never minded the rumpling of her curls as she hid her face on her mother's shoulder and sobbed out, "I am a selfish girl, but I'll truly try to be better, so he mayn't be disappointed in me by and by." "We all will," cried Meg. "I think too much of my looks and hate to work, but won't any more if I can help it. I'll try and be what he loves to call me, a little woman, and not be rough and wild, but to do my duty here instead of wanting to be somewhere else," said Jo, thinking that keeping her temper at home was a much harder task than facing a rebel or two down south. Beth said nothing, but wiped away her tears with the blue army sock and began to knit with all her might, losing no time in doing the duty that lay nearest her, while she resolved in her quiet little soul to be all that Father hoped to find her when the year brought round the happy coming home. Jo was the first to wake in the gray dawn of Christmas morning. No stockings hung at the fireplace, and for a moment she felt as much disappointed as she did long ago when her little sock fell down because it was so crammed with goodies. She woke Meg with a Merry Christmas. "Where is Mother?" asked Meg as she and Jo ran downstairs. "Goodness only knows. Some poor creature come a-beggin', and your ma went straight off to see what was needed. There never was such a woman for giving away victuals and drink, clothes and firin'," replied Hannah, who had lived with the family since Meg was born and was considered by them all more as a friend than a servant. "She will be back soon, I think, so fry your cakes and have everything ready," said Meg, looking over the presents which were collected in a basket and kept under the sofa, ready to be produced at the proper time. "Why, where is Amy's bottle of cologne?" she added, as the little flask did not appear. "She took it out a minute ago and went off with it to put a ribbon on it or some such notion," replied Jo, dancing about the room to take the first stiffness off the new army slippers. "How nice my handkerchiefs look, don't they? Hannah washed and ironed them for me, and I marked them all myself," said Beth, looking proudly at the somewhat uneven letters which had cost her such labor. "Bless the child! She's gone and put Mother on them instead of M. March. How funny!" cried Jo, taking up one.
"Isn't that right? I thought it was better to do it so, because Meg's initials are M.M., and I don't want anyone to use these but Marmy," said Beth, looking troubled.
"It's all right, dear, and a very pretty idea. Quite sensible, too, for no one can ever mistake now. It will please her very much, I know," said Meg, with a frown toward Jo and a smile for Beth.
"There's Mother! Hide the basket, quick!" cried Jo, as a door slammed and steps sounded in the hall. Amy came in hastily and looked rather abashed when she saw her sisters all waiting for her.
"Where have you been, and what are you hiding behind you?" asked Meg, surprised to see, by her hood and cloak, that lazy Amy had been out so early.
"Don't laugh at me, Jo! I didn't mean anyone should know till the time came. I only meant to change the little bottle for a big one, and I gave all my money to get it, and I'm truly trying not to be selfish any more."
As she spoke, Amy showed the handsome flask which replaced the cheap one, and looked so earnest and humble in her little effort to forget herself that Meg hugged her on the spot, and Jo pronounced her a trump, while Beth ran to the window and picked her finest rose to ornament the stately bottle.
"You see, I felt ashamed of my present after reading and talking about being good, so I ran around the corner and changed it the minute I was up. And I'm so glad, for mine is the handsomest now."
Another bang of the street door sent the basket under the sofa and the girls to the table, eager for breakfast.
"Merry Christmas, Marmy! Many of them! Thank you for our books. We read them, and mean to every day," they cried in chorus.
"Merry Christmas, little daughters. I'm glad you began at once, and hope you will keep on.
I want to say one word before we sit down. Not far away from here lies a poor woman with a little newborn baby. 6 children are huddled into one bed to keep from freezing, for they have no fire. There is nothing to eat over there, and the oldest boy came to me to tell me they were suffering hunger and cold. My girls, will you give them your breakfast as a Christmas present? They were all unusually hungry, having waited nearly an hour, and for a minute no one spoke. Only a minute, for Joe exclaimed impetuously, "I'm so glad you came before we began! May I go and help carry the things to the poor little children?" asked Beth eagerly. "I shall take the cream and the muffins," added Amy heroically, giving up the article she liked most. Meg was already covering the buckwheats and piling the bread into one big plate. "I thought you'd do it," said Miss March, smiling as if satisfied. "You shall all go and help me, and when we come back we will have bread and milk for breakfast and make up for it at dinner time." They were soon ready, and the procession set out. Fortunately, it was early, and they went through back streets, so few people saw them, and no one laughed at the queer party. A poor, bare, miserable room it was, with broken windows, no fire, ragged bedclothes, a sick mother, wailing baby, and a group of pale, hungry children cuddled under one old quilt trying to keep warm. How the big eyes stared, and the blue lips smiled as the girls went in. "Ach, mein Gott, it is good angels come to us," said the poor woman, crying for joy. "Funny angels in hoods and mittens," said Joe, and set them laughing. In a few minutes, it really did seem as if kind spirits had been at work there. Hannah, who had carried the wood, made a fire and stopped up the broken panes with old hats and her own cloak. Mrs. March gave the mother tea and gruel and comforted her with promises of help, while she dressed the little baby as tenderly as if it had been her own. The girls, meantime, spread the table, set the children round the fire, and fed them like so many hungry birds, laughing, talking, and trying to understand the funny broken English. "Das ist gut, die Engelkinder," cried the poor things as they ate, and warmed their purple hands at the comfortable blaze. The girls had never been called angel children before, and thought it was very agreeable, especially Joe, who had been considered a Sancho ever since she was born. That was a very happy breakfast, though they didn't get any of it, and when they went away, leaving comfort behind, I think there were not in the city four merrier people than the hungry little girls who gave away their breakfasts and contented themselves with bread and milk on Christmas morning. "That's loving our neighbor better than ourselves, and I like it," said Meg, as they set out their presents, while their mother was upstairs collecting clothes for the poor Hummels. Not a very splendid show, but there was a great deal of love done up in the few little bundles, and the tall vase of red roses, white chrysanthemums, and trailing vines, which stood in the middle, gave quite an elegant air to the table. "She's coming! Strike up, Beth! Open the door, Amy! 3 cheers for Marmee!" cried Joe, prancing about while Meg went to conduct Mother to the seat of honor. Beth played her gayest march. Amy threw open the door, and Meg enacted escort with great dignity. Mrs. March was both surprised and touched, and smiled with her eyes full as she examined her presents and read the little notes which accompanied them. The slippers went on at once. A new handkerchief was slipped into her pocket, well scented with Amy's cologne. The rose was fastened in her bosom, and the nice gloves were pronounced a perfect fit. There was a good deal of laughing and kissing and explaining in the simple, loving fashion which makes these home festivals so pleasant at the time, so sweet to remember long afterward. And then all fell to work.
Hello, my name is Carly Jones, and today I will be singing Some Children See Him by Wheela Hudson, music by Alfred Burt.
Some children see him lily white, the baby Jesus born this night. Some children see him lily white, with tresses soft and fair. Some children see him bronzed
and brown, with dark and heavy hair. Some children see him all undyed, this Savior whom we kneel beside. Some children see him all undyed, with skin of yellow hue. Some children see him dark as day, sweet mass unto whom we pray. Some children see him dark as day, and they love him too. The children in each different place will see the baby Jesus' face like theirs, but bright with heavenly grace and filled with holy light. Oh, lay aside each earthly thing, and with thy heart as offering, come worship now the infant King. 'Tis love that's born tonight.
My name is Karen Rains, and I'm going to be reading the opening story from a book entitled Where Angels Walk by Joan Wester Anderson, True Stories of Heavenly Visitors. This piece is called The Beginning. It was just past midnight on December 24th, 1983. The Midwest was shivering through a record-breaking cold spell, complete with gale-force winds and frozen water pipes. And although our suburban Chicago household was filled with the snug sounds of a family at rest, I couldn't be a part of them, not until our 21-year-old son pulled into the driveway. At that moment, Tim and his two roommates were driving home for Christmas, their first trip back since they had moved east last May. "Don't worry, Mom," Tim had reassured me over the phone last night. "We're going to leave before dawn tomorrow and drive straight through. We'll be fine." Kids, they do insane things. Under normal circumstances, I figured a Connecticut to Illinois trek ought to take about 18 hours. But the weather had turned so dangerously cold that radio reports warned against venturing outdoors even for a few moments. And we had heard nothing from the travelers. Distressed, I pictured them on a desolate road. What if they ran into car problems or lost their way? And if they had been delayed, why hadn't Tim phoned? Restlessly, I paced and prayed in the familiar shorthand all mothers know. God send someone to help them. By now, as I later learned, the trio had stopped briefly in Fort Wayne, Indiana, to deposit Don at his family home. Common sense suggested that Tim and Jim stay the rest of the night and resume their trek in the morning. But when does common sense prevail with invincible young adults? There were only 4 driving hours left to reach home. And although it was the coldest night in Midwest history and the highways were snowy and deserted, the two had started out again. They had been traveling for only a few miles on a rural access road to the Indiana Tollway when they noticed that the car's engine seemed sluggish, lurching erratically, and dying to 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tim glanced uneasily at Jim. "Do not," the radio announcer intoned, "repeat, do not venture outside tonight, friends. There is a record wind chill of 80 below zero, which means that exposed skin will freeze in less than a minute. The car surged suddenly, then coughed and slowed again. Tim, Jim spoke into the darkness, we're not going to stall here, are we?
We can't, Tim answered grimly as he pumped the accelerator. We'd die for sure.
But instead of picking up speed, the engine sputtered, chugging and slowing again. About a mile later, at the top of a small incline, the car crawled to a frozen stop. Horrified, Tim and Jim looked at each other in the darkened interior. They could see across the fields in every direction, but incredibly, theirs was the only vehicle in view. For the first time, they faced the fact that they were in enormous danger. There was no traffic, no refuge ahead, not even a farmhouse light blinking in the distance. It was as if they had landed on an alien snow-covered planet. And the appalling, unbelievable cold. Never in Tim's life had he experienced anything so intense. They couldn't run for help. He knew that now for sure. He and Jim were young and strong, but even if shelter was only a short distance away, they couldn't survive. The temperature would kill them in a matter of minutes. Someone will come along soon, Jim muttered, looking in every direction. They're bound to.
I don't think so, Tim said. You heard the radio. Everyone in the world is inside tonight, except us.
Then what are we going to do?
I don't know.
Tim tried starting the engine again, but the ignition key clicked hopelessly in the silence. Bone-chilling cold had penetrated the car's interior, and his feet were already growing numb.
Well, God, he prayed, echoing my own distant plea, you're the only one who can help us now.
It seemed impossible to stay awake much longer. Then, as if they had already slipped into a dream, they saw headlights flashing at the car's left rear. But that was impossible, for they had seen no twin pinpricks of light in the distance, no hopeful approach. Where had the vehicle come from? Had they already died? But no, for miraculously someone was knocking on the driver's side window. Need to be pulled? In disbelief, they heard the muffled shout. But it was true. Their rescuer was driving a tow truck.
Yes! Oh, yes! Thanks!
Quickly, the two conferred as the driver, saying nothing more, drove around to the front of the car and attached chains. If there were no garages open at this hour, they would ask him to take them back to Don's house, where they could spend the rest of the night. Swathed almost completely in a furry parka, hood, and a scarf up to his eyes, the driver nodded at their request but said nothing more. He was calm, they noted, as he climbed into his truck, seemingly unconcerned about the life-threatening circumstances in which he had found them. Strange that he's not curious about us, Tim mused, and isn't even explaining where he came from or how he managed to approach without our seeing him. And had there been lettering on the side of the truck? Tim hadn't noticed any. He's going to give us a big bill on a night like this. I'll have to borrow some money from Don or his dad. But Tim was exhausted from the ordeal, and gradually, as he leaned against the seat, his thoughts slipped away. They passed two locked service stations, stopped to alert Don from a payphone, and were soon being towed back through the familiar Fort Wayne neighborhood. Hushed, Christmas lights long since extinguished, and families asleep, Don still seemed the most welcoming street they had ever been on. The driver maneuvered carefully around the cul-de-sac and pulled up in front of Don's house. Numb with cold, Tim and Jim raced to the side door where Don was waiting, then tumbled into the blessedly warm kitchen, safe at last. Don slammed the door against the icy blast. "Hey, what happened?" he began, but Tim interrupted. "The tow truck driver, Don. I have to pay him. I need to borrow..." "Wait a minute." Don frowned, looking past his friends through the window. "I don't see any tow truck out there." Tim and Jim turned around. There, parked alone at the curb, was Tim's car. There had been no sound in the crystal clear night of its release from the chains, no door slam, no chug of an engine pulling away.
There had been no bill for Tim to pay, no receipt to sign, no farewell or thank you or Merry Christmas. Stunned, Tim raced back down the driveway to the curb, but there were no taillights disappearing in the distance, no engine noise echoing through the silent streets, nothing at all to mark the tow truck's presence. Then Tim saw the tire tracks traced in the wind-blown snowdrifts. But there was only one set of marks ringing the cul-de-sac curve, and they belonged to Tim's car. When Christmas carols fill the air and our worries regress in a temporary world of holiday nostalgia, everyone believes in angels. But it's harder to accept the likelihood that the multitude of heavenly hosts on that long-ago Bethlehem hillside has relevance in our lives, too, that God's promise to send his angels to protect and rescue each of his children is a faithful pact, continuing for all eternity throughout every season of the year. Angels don't get much attention today. If the spirit world is acknowledged at all, it's usually the dark side, the bizarre satanic cults that are wreaking so much havoc, especially among our youth. Yet there is evidence that good spirits are also at work here on earth, combating evil, bringing news, warning us of danger, consoling us in our suffering, then vanishing, just as the angels did on that first Christmas night. Angels don't submit to litmus tests, testify in court, or slide under a microscope for examination. Thus, their existence cannot be quote-unquote proved by the guidelines we humans usually use. To no one, perhaps, requires a willingness to suspend judgment, to open ourselves to possibilities we've only dreamed about. The best and most beautiful things in the world cannot be seen or even touched, Helen Keller said. They must be felt with the heart. Was it an angel? Our family will never know for sure. But on Christmas Eve in 1983, I heard the whisper of wings as a tow truck driver answered a heavenly summons and brought our son safely home.
My name is Julie, and I used to read to my dad all the time. My sisters and I and my mom all read to him, but I'm getting ahead of myself. My dad, Jerry Hall, went blind when he was 14 years old. He spent a year flat on his back that year. He'd lost his first eye when he was 7 or 8, and then at 14 had a retinal detachment, and the doctors hoped that by lying flat on his back his retina would reattach, but it didn't. During that year, a teacher from the public school that he attended came to tutor him regularly because he didn't want to fall behind and she didn't want him to either. After a year, no reattached retina, fully blind, my dad went back to school, caught up where he belonged, and was, at least according to my grandmother, the first blind person to graduate from a public high school in Kansas. Now, because of the dedication and the help of the teacher that came and visited him and worked with him the year that he was on his back, he developed a great affinity for teaching and for teachers and knew that he was called to teach. And that's what he eventually did. After he'd gone blind, he learned how to play the trumpet, loved music, all kinds of music, classical, jazz, Louis Armstrong, and oh man, he wanted to play just like Harry James. And from what I've heard, he came pretty darn close. After high school, Dad went on to the University of Kansas, where he graduated in 1955 with a degree in music education, with the help of my mom, who always claimed she should have gotten the degree every bit as much as he. He had married her in 1956, and she read and helped him with all of his papers and all of his schoolwork. He got a job teaching band in the public schools of Kansas. He taught hundreds of students how to read music, how to play instruments, how to be a part of a band, and yes, he even led the marching band. One year, a newspaper reporter was doing a story on him, and he was on the bleachers observing the marching band rehearsal, so to speak, and hollered down to the field, "Straighten up, your rows are crooked, straighten up." And the reporter said, "How do you know that, Mr. Hall?" And he said, "Oh, come on, it's a high school marching band. I'll guarantee you their rows are crooked." Anyway, hundreds of students later, my sisters and I were among them. He would accept nothing but the best from any of us. He turned his nose up at anything less than wonderful, and he wanted things done right, played right, sounding right. Now, in spite of all of his demand for perfection in music, the one thing that was guaranteed to bring a tear to Dad's eye every time, and I do mean every single time, was every year at Christmas, when the first graders would sing Silent Night. He'd keep it together. You could see him struggling through the entire song until they got to that phrase at the end, that phrase that any trained singer knows. You have to sing with perfection, clarity, and grace. But a first grader will not. You know the one. Sleep in heavenly peace. And the more the children slid up on that one word, the bigger the tears would be rolling down his cheeks. Now, I don't have a group of first graders here with me to sing for you the way Dad would love it. But along with his love of classical and jazz, strangely enough, being a man from Kansas, he also loved music from the Appalachian Mountain areas. The songs, the tunes, and one of his favorite Christmas songs was a song that he taught to me called the Cherry Tree Carol. And thinking about my dad, I'd like to try and sing it for you the way he sang it and the way he always taught it to me. When Joseph was an old man, an old man was he. He married Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. He married Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. Then Mary spoke to Joseph, so meek and so mild. "Joseph, gather me some cherries, for I am with child. Joseph, gather me some cherries, for I am with child." Then Joseph flew in anger flew he. "Let the father of the baby gather cherries for thee. Let the father of the baby gather cherries for thee." Then Jesus spoke softly did he. "Let my mother gather cherries, bow low down cherry tree. Let my mother gather cherries, bow low down cherry tree." The cherry tree bowed low down to the ground. And Mary gathered cherries while Joseph stood around. And Mary gathered cherries while Joseph stood around. Then Joseph gathered Mary all on his left knee. "What have I done, Lord? Have mercy on me. What have I done, Lord? Have mercy on me." Then Joseph gathered Jesus all on his right knee. Oh, tell me, little baby, when thy birthday will be. Oh, tell me, little baby, when thy birthday will be. The 6th day of January, my birthday will be. When the stars and the elements shall tremble with glee. When the stars and the elements shall tremble with glee. And I send that out to all the little girls and all the daddies that share that wonderful, special love. Merry Christmas.